There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician. Jenny hit Austin. My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Just want to do things my own way, you know.
Countrymen, lend me your ears. It's Phil Pritchett on the P2 Podcast. Broadcasting in beautiful high-definition audio, or something quite like it, to all four corners of this bluish-green planet that you and I both call lovingly our Earth. Yes, folks, it is that time again, the podcast where I sit here from Trinidad World Recording Studios, which is wherever I am. Broadcast my thoughts from the front lines of family, rock and roll, music, current events, and whatever else I can seem to think of. The blowback on last week's rant, as I declared I wanted to apply for illegal citizenship, has flowed in. We'll get to more emails on that in a future broadcast. I'm now going to the DMV and realizing I might be better off just not being in the machine, just not being in the computer. They got no files on me. So thanks for your feedback on that, folks. Good and negative. Although I found most people had a similar experience, at least, and if not, similar thoughts on the matter. So just trying to frame the debate out there, man. You know, everybody just yelling about immigration or this and that, building the fence and all that. It kind of misses a very core way to look at it. You want a fence or not a fence? I'm like, well, I don't know. How does that affect me, a fence rolling from here? It kind of gets down to, and not just immigration, but just people in jail or in, I mean, what people would be qualified to do with licenses and cars and stuff like that. I don't know. Let the debate ensue. Phil's just here to frame it for you, put it in a context of his own real life. So take it for whatever it's worth. Well, what you been doing, Phil, all summer? Well, I've got some summer reading, always reading some books. I'll tell you what I've been reading a lot about and thinking a lot about, learning about, something all of us Texans know so well. But we just know the name, the initials, the reputation, perhaps. But not much more if you're like me. I mean, I kind of grew up hearing about him, but I didn't know a whole lot about the guy. I'd always heard about his political genius, his cunning, and his ruthlessness. I'm talking about our own Texan, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Lyndon Baines Johnson. LBJ. You know of whom I speak? LBJ. Everything in Texas is named after LBJ. The library, the state park. Every city's got an LBJ freeway or something like that. Lyndon Johnson, man. I have been reading about him. He's just sort of come up in a lot of these we'll talk about Texas oil books I've been reading that are pretty interesting. You might want to check into another time, but The guy that keeps emerging in these books is old Lyndon Johnson himself. And you think, I didn't know much about Lyndon Johnson. He's a Texan, Democrat, civil rights, you know, took over after Kennedy got shot. Lady Bird planted the wildflowers. I don't know. That's about my extent of it. I knew all his other stuff, you know, Vietnam, stretching it out, all that. But, man, let me tell you what. There's a great book out there. Robert Caro wrote a three-part series on Lyndon Johnson, a biography. I mean, you can't even fit it into one book. You've got Means to Ascent, Rise to Power are the first two small books, I think. And then the big, huge one he's got in the middle is called Master of the Senate, The Years of Lyndon Johnson. When Lyndon Johnson went to the United States Senate for Texas. And I had not read all the other Caro's two other books that really talk about Johnson's childhood and growing up poor and all the how he was obsessed with success and couldn't face failure and all this and how he was just kind of this manic, driven guy with this big personality. Crude, crass, boorish, you know, and all these things. Just a bigger-than-life guy, a monster of a man, LBJ. No avoiding him. So Master of the Senate picks up with our old friend Lyndon Johnson. I guess it was late 40s, I want to say, when he got in there. I think that's right, 47, 8, 9, something like that. Post-war, the Truman era, so maybe mid-40s, Harry Truman. And LBJ, I think he was in the House of Representatives when Roosevelt was president. And the big thing to remember about LBJ, the reason you drive around here, I'm always curious about this. You see these big statues of these guys and the name. It's cool just to go deep and just find out the core essence of what that guy did. Even aside from the big facts, like, oh, he did this, he was president of the United States. Okay, cool, but go back and find out just who the guy is, man. What made him tick? What drove him? And that's kind of how you really get to know somebody. I find that very interesting in my historical readings. We talked about George Washington and what a great leader he was in McCullough's book, 1776, a little while back. So this is kind of along those lines. What makes a leader? What makes a big guy? Well, LBJ is fascinating, man. It takes a while to get into the Master of the Senate book because it takes a while for Caro to illustrate how Johnson is using power, how he accrues power around him to get what he wants. And if you're like me, I hear that statement and go, what does that mean? How can you even do that? I don't know. You and I, we're novices to this whole thing. We don't know anything about it. Or we'd all be very, very powerful. Well, Johnson, first of all, he makes friends with all these old Texas guys. He understands, he always said he understood power. LBJ understood power. He understood where it was. He was a poor kid from nowhere, but he understood. He befriended influential people. He looked for influential people who might, and then find where the void is in their life. And then LBJ would fill that very subtly and very effectively. And he just kept notes on all this kind of stuff. Sam Rayburn was the Speaker of the House, the great Texas leader, and was a friend of Lyndon's. And a new Lyndon coming up from the ranks. So when LBJ was in the Senate, LBJ always, he would just go over there and kiss Sam Rayburn on the head. Just go, hello, daddy, how you doing? Good to see you. He'd have a Lady Bird make Sam Rayburn's favorite coconut cake or whatever and take it to him himself on his birthday. This kind of stuff. This is what Lyndon was. And Rayburn, they'd all roll their eyes. Oh, Lyndon, he's a climber. He's this and that. But he filled a big void in those guys' lives. Those some of those powerful men were indeed lonely and sort of off to themselves. Richard Russell was one such man. When LBJ came into the Senate, the guy that ran the Southern Democrats was Georgia's Richard Russell. He came from a long family of conservative Democrats who ran Georgia. You know, back in the 40s and 50s, you had the Republicans. They were all over the place until Eisenhower kind of came along in the 50s and got them into power a little bit. But you really had the Northern liberal Democrats, right, the Northeast, the civil rights and the progressives. And then in the South, man, you just had LBJ and the Russells and these. Man, these guys were just what you'd call today like Tea Party Republicans in a lot of ways. Yeah, I mean, just conservative, just the old, their dads were on the KKK, that kind of stuff, man, a lot of them. So, it was a conservative bastion, but there were a lot of conservative states that would vote in a big block. So the Northern Democrats were always frustrated with the Southern Democrats and vice versa, because there was a great balancing power. It was almost like having three political parties in the House of Representatives and the Senate in the early, late 40s and 50s, because you had the kind of the Northern Democrats, the Southern Democrats, and the Republicans, and it was just kind of a three-party system in a very real sense. Well, LBJ's lifetime goal was to be president of the United States. Ever since he was a teenager, a little boy, he was just, that was his ambition, the ultimate quest of power. So LBJ gets into the Senate, and he becomes a majority leader, or a minority leader, I guess, under Eisenhower. And Caro clearly illustrates how Lyndon, who would ingratiate himself with Russell, okay, like he would go to baseball games with Dick Russell, you know, from Georgia. But Russell was the big guy that controlled all the Southern Democrats. He became big friends with him. And then he was big friends with Sam Rayburn, who was the Speaker of the House. So he had these guys under his thumb, man, under his charm, his spell. Then, but Johnson knew one thing. He wanted to be president, and he knew damn well that no Republican and no Northern Democrats were ever going to support Lyndon Johnson for president. A Southern guy. No. So Johnson becomes a party leader, Democratic Party leader. And he's also got, by the way, Lyndon also has befriended Sid Richardson, Clint Murchison, all these huge Texas oil men who had really come up the ranks in the 40s and just made fortunes, man. So Johnson had access to cash. He had guys leaving his office just to go to Texas and pick up, you know, plane loads of cash for various campaigns and stuff like that. And the Senate in the 30s and 20s and on back, as it was described by Caro in the book, the United States Senate was not meant to be led, okay? It was not meant to be led, to have a consensus of anything. You had two representatives from 50 or 48 or whatever, very different states, right? You just had the Texas guys. They were kind of like this, and you had these guys. And there were small coalitions, you know, like you kind of had the Southern Bloc led by Russell and Georgia's Russell. You had some guys in the North, you know, you had Rockefeller-type people in the Northeast that controlled some things. But there was not, everyone was from their individual state. The Wyoming guys went in there and voted, and they left. The Minnesota guys, they voted, they left, whatever. They were from Minnesota, by God, they went back. That's just how everybody operated. It was not, you didn't get there and feel like you had to be on a team, right? Well, LBJ sees this before anybody else. So LBJ, little guy, poor guy in Texas who wants to be president of the United States, he's finally cut his way all the way up through the ranks. He's pushed his way onto all these committees, you know, to grandstand and be on the cover of Time magazine investigating wasteful spending in the military or something. I don't know. So he's kind of made a name for himself as a politician. Well, now he's the party leader in the Senate. And he's all the Southern Democrats love him, the Alabama guys and the Georgia guys. But this isn't enough for LBJ. That's just a few states, a handful of senators. So LBJ starts to accrue power. One, by getting money from his oil buddies back in Texas. He's got a lot of cash, and there weren't a lot of rules back in those days on how that cash could be allocated. He also, so he had access to all this money. He also had these minions who worked in his office. He was a ruthless tyrant, man. I mean, the stories about him, you've probably heard stories about him just like taking a leak off the balcony of his Senate office down below just while he's giving a press conference. Stuff like that, man. Just farmer blowing on the floor, you know, just scratching his balls in a meeting with people, and just, I mean, the crassest, most barnyard guy you can imagine, LBJ. This was him. Just crass. People couldn't believe it. He'd get up and just collar people, like grab them by the lapels and go, hey, we need your help on this, you know, to get bills passed and stuff. But he couldn't just do that now, could he? He was just kind of the, you know, majority leader or the Democratic leader. So Johnson sees this. So he gets all this money from Texas. He's got this flowing through him. He's got Uncle Sam Rayburn, his buddy, runs the House of Representatives. He's also got all these minions that he just rules with an iron fist in his office, always recruiting the best and brightest guys to be in his on his staff. And he sends them out to the cloakrooms and to the parties and golf tournaments and whatever the hell else all the senators are. And he says, get me information. I need to know what this guy's thinking, what's important to him. He doesn't care about this tax bill that we're trying to get through, but what does he care about? He cares, you know, he cared about the water bill, or he cared about his reelection in 2 years. So Johnson just sat at his desk, man, sending guys out, chain smoking, scratching his balls, and just accruing power, just cash underneath his desk. Lyndon Johnson, the Senate, this is what you had. And before anybody really even knew what happened, the other senators, the proud man from Maine and from Oregon, I'm just going here to vote. What do you mean? I'm beholden to no man. I'm a senator from this state. Well, just a second there, dude. Now what's happening? Now what is happening? The balance of power has suddenly shifted in the Senate, 100 senators, by one guy, Lyndon Johnson. How's that, Phil? What are you talking about? Now they're all trying to get reelected. All of them want to get reelected, right? They're like, man, I had a campaign coming up. I got to get money. Where can I get some money? What did everybody say? Hey, if you need money, you go to Lyndon. Lyndon can get money. Okay? The guy's like, oh, okay. Guys would come in like, oh, we got this vote. You know, we got a majority vote on that. Lyndon would just look up and go, no, you don't. You don't got a damn thing. What do you mean, Lyndon? Lyndon knew exactly how everyone was going to vote, all his little guys out there in all the cloakrooms. He knew that he said, you're still 3 votes short. You think you've got it, but you don't. So all of a sudden, Lyndon Johnson's little office there in the Senate, leader of the Democrats, had a line down the hall of all these senators, hat in hand, crawling into Lyndon's office. Hey, Lyndon, I need some money for my campaign. And I also need to know, the next guy comes in, I need to know the vote. Who can I talk to? Who knows the vote? Who knows if we can win? Go talk to Lyndon. He knows what the vote is before it happens. Go talk to Lyndon. You need money? Go talk to Lyndon. You want to find out what's going on in the House of Representatives? You want to know what they're going to pass through? There's only one guy who knows Sam Rayburn. That's Lyndon Johnson. So all of a sudden, if you were a senator of the United States in the early 50s, and you needed money, you needed to know the vote, you needed to know what was going on in the House of Representatives, or you needed to know if you were going to get reelected, anything, there was only one guy who had all the answers. LBJ. Picking his nose, scratching his butt, feet on the desk, chain smoking, hurling insults at people, dropping F-bombs left and right, running the whole damn show. And they didn't like it, of course, the northern liberals. But then LBJ does something worthy of old Don Corleone, the godfather himself. He reaches out to some senators and gives them key appointments to certain committees. LBJ gets all these senator committees, you know, all these, it was all based on seniority. The oldest guy got the next chair when the guy died or retired or didn't get elected. It's kind of complicated, but Lyndon would convince people with the leverage he had, with the money, with knowing the vote, with Rayburn, all this stuff. He starts doling out favors to key northern Democrats first. Hubert Humphrey was one in Minnesota who hated LBJ, but all of a sudden LBJ's calling him, taking him to lunch. Hey, man, just under the table, hey, here's some money for your campaign. I think we need to get you back. We need to have more men like you in the Senate, you know. So Humphreys gets reelected. And then LBJ said, not only that, I'm going to make you chairman of this big committee over here. Humphreys is ecstatic. He's like, I can't believe this is my big break. So now he's on this committee. Well, but he owes Lyndon Johnson a lot, doesn't he? It's like the godfather, you know?
You didn't want to be in my debt, so you didn't come ask for me for any favors. One day I'll come to you. I'll ask you to do a favor for me, and that day may never come.
But that day came for all those guys with Lyndon Johnson, man. So when Lyndon Johnson starts running for president in 1960, of course, he runs up against a brick wall. I haven't gotten to this part of the book. Johnson controls the whole dang Senate. He's got all the money. He's got all the votes. He knows what everybody's doing, what everybody's thinking. He knows everything. And he just transforms the whole thing. And by the end of his Senate run, he has set the chessboard in the favor of the Democrats. And he's also done huge favors for Republicans and Northern Democrats alike. And so, when he starts his presidential bid, he knows he can count on these guys to support him. But he knew exactly who the guys were that he needed. He didn't waste any time on some guy. Oh, he's just from New Hampshire, some guy. You know, who cares? He knew that the influence some of these other guys had. So that was the genius of Johnson. People talk about he was the most genius politician in modern times. It's just no one. He was a step ahead of everybody. And he saw that Eisenhower, they said, oh, Eisenhower's never going to get elected. No, Eisenhower's never going to get elected. Johnson knew he would. Johnson said he'll win in a landslide. And you know what? What's more, he's going to be there 8 years. So we better prepare ourselves now. So Johnson just set out his chessboard years in advance, 8 years in advance, to make himself president of the United States. Way out, and other guys got caught flat-footed or with no money, or they lost an election in the Senate, and they were done. Out. So Johnson keeps trudging forward. And sure enough, man, he gets to like the 1960 election. Like I said, I haven't gotten there when of course he's JFK's running mate. And to say the least, he runs up against the greatest Northern Democrat liberal family of all, the Kennedys, who despise Lyndon Johnson for many of the reasons I'm outlining right here. A crass, boorish Texan, offensive, awful, powerful, corrupt, just anything you can use to describe Lyndon LBJ, that's what he was. But LBJ had everybody else in a headlock, but he didn't have the Kennedys in a headlock. But what did the Kennedys need? What did the Kennedys need on the ticket to help win some southern states for Harvard Johnny over there? What do they have to get? What do they do? Well, they had to get the most popular Southern Democrat guy on the ticket. Lyndon wanted to be the presidential nominee, but he ends up taking to be his vice president, of course, with the full intention of becoming president. You know, I am not. I don't want to end the podcast on a dark note. I am not a conspiracy theorist. I've never been. I've never been real fascinated by the. The JFK assassination. I tell you what, reading this book, I don't know, everybody gets caught up in the magic bullet, or there's another shooter on the Kennedy assassination, or this, or that, the Cubans, or the Mafia. It might have been all those people, or none of them, or whatever. Oswald might have acted alone. I think that's probably a very big probability. But it's hard to think of anybody being able to pull that off, or having the motive to pull it off. But I'll tell you what, man, there's always been theories about Johnson. I'm not trying to put that theory forward. But I'll tell you what, man, reading Master of the Senate by Robert Caro, when you get a sense of the drive and what this guy will not do to fail. And because what happened after Johnson and Kennedy get elected president and vice president, word gets out pretty quick. They hate Johnson. He's terrible. And he's too powerful, for one thing, also. Johnson tries to do, like, presidential meetings and stuff. He makes the Kennedys mad. They're like, look, when JFK runs again in 64, Lyndon is out. He's not on the ticket. We're done with him. We don't need him. Finished. And Johnson knew this, man, about 1962. Johnson went back to all of his oil guys, all of his money guys in Dallas, in Texas, everywhere, saying, I'm your guy in Washington, me, LBJ, but I'm out. Let me tell you what, these Kennedys are embarrassing me. They're putting me out to pasture. They're kicking me out. Everything we've built will be gone. I'll never be president. And I tell you what, it does. I'm not putting the conspiracy theory forward, but I'm telling you what, I'm like, the killing of Kennedy accomplished about 5 of LBJ's goals. It kept him in power. It made him president. It kept him in the good graces of all his political capital he built up through the years that he didn't want to sacrifice. And he hated Kennedy anyway. I don't know. And you say, well, oh, man, God, he would never do that, man. LBJ, he wouldn't be that cold-blooded. You read this book and you just think, oh, no. So I don't know, man. Like I say, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't know all the facts. But it's always kind of loose. Like, well, how could they have really done that? How could Lyndon Johnson have something like that pulled off in Texas? And with what motive? I'm like, dude, he had buckets of motive, and he had barrels of means to do it. There's no question. Now, as any good guy like that, he probably didn't give the order, if it was associated with him at all. He probably didn't say anything. He might have just left it in the room, like, if someone could take care of this, we could just keep doing business as usual, and walk out with a heavy statement hanging in the air, that kind of thing. Well, no one rid me of this meddlesome priest kind of deal. to quote, what is it? Oh, God, what old play was that? I forget. Shakespeare or something? Anyway, LBJ, man, bigger than life. But, man, pretty sad. He died pretty soon after he was president, you know, all through the 60s, 68. I think he died in, like, 72. He was only, like, 65 years old, 64, something like that. Smoking, just heart attack, crazy, anxiety, stress. Just kind of a miserable, corrupt, driven guy, but whose political genius has never been matched. How he saw the moves, the chessboard ahead. Eisenhower, Kennedy, how he dealt with all these things, how he ingratiated himself with all these Northern Democrats and enemies of his, did favors for them, even while they despised him. They depended on him and would do what he wanted. That is the greatness and the power and the political genius of Lyndon Baines Johnson, your Texas senator. So read that book, man, Robert Caro, Master of the Senate, LBJ, man. It is just, it's just, it's like reading, you can't watch Mad Men or good grief, an episode of Dallas or something just stinks compared to this, man. There's no more high drama or higher stakes than LBJ in real life. That's why I read history, man. It's always better than nonfiction. Hey, Phil here. That's what I've been reading this summer. Pretty heavy stuff, man. Good grief. Last week I said I wanted to be an illegal immigrant. Now I'm saying LBJ would have had the means and the motive to have Kennedy killed. Good grief, man. What are you doing on this show, Phil? What's this thing turning into? I don't know. Maybe it's the heat. Heat's making me crazy. I'm saying crazy stuff. Well, give me your feedback as always. Phil at philpritchard.com. 817-733-5256. A lot of hot opinions out there on all this kind of stuff. Come record, man. We got everybody coming to record this summer. Rich O'Toole and so many more and so many good friends of mine locally. I'm going down to Austin with Brian Hunt and down there with my friend Darren Norman going down to Austin to a Yellow Dog and to some other studios down there helping produce some guys in Austin. I'll travel, man. You know, if you're making a record in Houston or Beaumont or Denver and you say, hey, let's fly in Phil to help us make the record. I'd love to do it, man. I do it all the time. Thanks so much, and thanks for hitting that tip jar, PayPal tip jar on the P2Podcast.com webpage. Thanks, folks, for listening. Give me your feedback, and we'll talk to you next time. Much tougher. We're in a band, man. We're in a band.